Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Phoenix, Arizona, it's time for Valley Business Radio, spotlighting the Valley's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Hello and welcome to Valley Business Radio, where we tell the stories that traditional media tends to ignore and help connect you to the right people. I'm your host, Dr. Adrian McIntyre, and I'm joined in the studio today by three fascinating guests from Arizona's cannabis industry. I want to welcome Christina Morse, COO of Rebel HR. Thanks for joining us, Christina.
Thank you, Adrian.
And Alex Cushman, President of Procure Solutions.
Thanks for having me, Adrian.
Thanks for being here. And then as well, we have Ed Cheney, CEO of Canafil CBD. Welcome, Ed.
Good morning, Adrian and the audience. Thanks for having me here.
Thanks for being here. Now, I'm excited to do this. We're actually planning to have a recurring series dealing with this industry here on Business Radio X, but this is our inaugural segment. So I'm looking forward to learning more about your businesses, learning more about your perspective on what's happening with cannabis in Arizona in particular. Christina, let's start with you. Tell us a little bit about Rebel HR. What do you do and how do you serve the industry?
Absolutely. So we provide HR solutions specifically for the cannabis industry. So whether you're THC touching, CBD or hemp related, and we provide a variety of solutions. So I focus specifically on the HR solutions that can be anything from employee relations to benefits implementation to payroll services. And then we also have Rebel Rock Accounting that handles a full suite of accounting solutions for the cannabis industry.
You've been in HR for a long time. What made you decide to specialize and create a business specific to the cannabis industry?
Absolutely. So those that know me know that I have been a big fan of alternative healing for a long time. So the fact that I support the cannabis industry comes as no surprise. And really, I have to thank my business partners. So I have two CPA business partners that started out on the accounting side first, and they really found that they were coming across a lot of HR types of questions that they were being asked because, people tend to merge those two fields between accounting and HR, and they couldn't answer those questions. And so I was fortunate enough to meet these two wonderful women, and we just fell in line with our belief system. And so we created a 100% women-owned company to address and tackle these issues. And we found that really within the cannabis industry, there's not a huge presence of HR professionals. And I think that that's really due to a lot of stereotypes that are out there about what the cannabis industry consists of, right? Everyone thinks that we're just, a bunch of crazy cowboys out there smoking pot all day, and they don't really look past that, right? A lot of HR people have lived in a very black and white world for a long time, and they've spent a lot of time creating anti-drug policies, right? So tend to not be jumping on board with the industry, and I've always had a little bit different viewpoint on one on healing, and so obviously have a big love for the cannabis industry there, and then also just on how to conduct business and how to support businesses in their HR solutions.
Fantastic. And you're a Phoenix native, but you have lived and worked in a lot of different places, and I'm sure this shapes the way you look at what you're doing here. I first met you when you were giving a talk at Disrupt HR, and you charted this unconventional journey, living outside the box, not as a concept, but as a very real set of experiences. Can you talk a little bit about your backstory and what had you go through that period and then come back here to start what you're doing with Rebel HR?
Sure, absolutely. So I do have 20 years background in the HR field, and I guess I've always been a little bit unconventional in all aspects of life. But I found myself a few years ago, my daughter was graduating from college, so she's an ASU graduate. And I was fortunate enough that she graduated when she was 20 years old. And so I was still young enough to go out and travel the world. So I decided when she graduated that I was going to take that opportunity and work 100% remote, and ended up spending over the period of 18 months, I lived in 14 different countries. And you really do see a different perspective when you go out there, and you just see the way that people conduct themselves in different environments and the laws and rules and regulations. So the first place that I went was actually Portugal, and they had decriminalized drug drug, I don't know all the exact terminology behind it, but they had decriminalized drugs. So basically you could have drugs and you wouldn't be prosecuted. I don't know what the exact terminology is for that. But it you know, here we've been raised with this fear, right, of that happening. And we think, oh my gosh, that's going to just be a complete free-for-all, and, you know, people are probably performing all types of crime. And actually, they found that crime had gone down, and I found it to be an incredibly safe place to be. And, you know, here I am, a, you know, not very big blonde girl in a foreign country. I don't speak the language, and I'm walking the streets by myself. I'm working U.S. hours, so oftentimes I'm outside maybe walking from the co-working space to my apartment at 10, 11, midnight, and I feel totally comfortable and I feel totally safe. And it really started to open my eyes to the fact that some of the fear-mongering that goes on around some of these things actually isn't true. So,
you know, it's, I mean, as a, I was born in 73. So as a child of the late 70s, early 80s, you know, I remember, you know, Nancy Reagan's war on drugs. I didn't understand at the time a lot of the historical forces, the way in which the war on drugs was entangled with racist policies and the impact on inner cities and things of that nature. I've come to learn a bit more about that as a social scientist and as a grown-up. But, you know, those vivid images of, you know, the egg in the frying pan, this right. is your brain on drugs and all and things of that nature. And of course, nobody at the time was talking about this is your brain on prescription pharmaceuticals.
Right.
But I mean, without taking a position on that, although I have one, we have had a very one-sided public conversation in this country. Look, it's not to say there isn't abuse. It's not to say that there isn't problems. It's not to say there isn't things that, but the degree to which conceptions of a legitimate business industry have been shaped by this kind of propaganda is something I think we need to have a more open conversation about. Now, within the HR world, this must be very relevant because people are HR organizations within companies typically play defense and try to hold people accountable to certain policies. They, you know, are covering the company's assets, mm-hmm. as it were. Right?
CYA.
Yeah. And really trying to prevent some of the significant problems that happen whenever you have a company with people in it.
Right.
Right. But talk about some of the unique dimensions of your work in the cannabis industry, or are there any unique? Is it the same kind of work, or are there some differences?
I would say it's the same kind of work in terms of the actual functions of the job, right? So you have recruiting in all industries, and you have recruiting in cannabis, right? You have employee relations, you have benefits, you have payroll. However, there are nuances of the industry that impact how you do that job, right? So, for example, employee relations, let's talk about like employee handbooks. That's across the board. You have that in all organizations. And as you mentioned, a lot of times we're doing CYA. I like to think about it a little bit differently in the sense that I don't want it to come to a lawsuit. I don't want it to come to the point that we are now presenting a handbook in court and having to use that as a defense. I want to use it as an offense. And let's stop writing everything in legalese terms that nobody understands, but they're required to sign off on. And probably the reason why you're getting to a court case to begin with is because there's a miscommunication. There's some either... You know, it's usually not by intentional fault. It's usually that an employee feels like they weren't, something wasn't explained to them by the company, or the company didn't have proper policies, or they weren't executing on those policies equally amongst all employees. But typically, that's usually a communication issue. And so if we address the communication issue first, hopefully we can avoid that piece. Now, do we still need to have some of those pieces in place? Yes, absolutely, because you can't foresee all events and you can't prevent everything. But let's start at the beginning and look at why are these things happening to begin with? And is there something we can do to prevent that? Because if we communicate with our employees in such a way that they understand what's happening, nothing comes as a surprise to them. maybe we can avoid the whole situation to begin with, and then it becomes less important to have 97 pages of, lawyer speak. Sorry, love my attorneys, but, not everybody understands this, right? Even sometimes I read things and I don't understand them. And I started working in a law firm when I was 17 years old. So I've seen a lot of legalese.
Well, and it's like psychologist Abraham Maslow famously said, if all you have is a hammer, then everything looks like a nail. And if all you have is a legal approach to HR, then everything looks like a potential court case to be avoided, something to be mitigated, things of that nature. I'm very interested, not only in this industry, but across the board, about proactive HR organizations that own many types of functions within the company, including the storytelling role internally, the culture role internally, really nurturing and supporting people to flourish at work. You typically hear about that sort of thing with wellness programs, or storytelling is the domain of the marketing department. And I think a forward-looking HR organization can really get their hands around much of what's going on in the company wherever there's people involved. Right. Now, you provide outsourced HR services. Is that an increasing trend for outside firms to be providing these things, or is that only appropriate for certain types of businesses? Talk a little bit about that in general.
It's definitely increasing in terms of trends. You see a lot more outsourcing happening. I find that oftentimes the folks that I'm dealing with within the cannabis industry are usually they're usually in the small to mid-sized business range, right? And it becomes a financial burden for them to try and hire on a full-time employee. Anytime you're talking about headcount, you have to be very intentional with who you're hiring and bringing on your team when every salary counts. And it's not that HR isn't seen as important, but oftentimes HR is seen as an obstacle to business objectives. And so that, provides people with an incentive to not want to hire an HR professional. But then also, when you are talking about an experienced HR professional, you're talking about salaries that can get into six figures. And that's a big burden for a smaller company to bear. Even larger companies, that's a pretty big burden.
And certainly early stage companies, where it's probably more important than ever, but the cash flow isn't there.
Right.
It will be there.
It will be there. And they need this infrastructure built in the beginning to make sure that everything's developed in the proper way and that they have the proper strategies, because, as we're talking about bringing on the right people, you start with recruiting. So you need to know what your brand is, what your story is right out of the gate. And then you can properly assess people to make sure that they fit within that culture. Usually people don't work out in a role, not because they don't have the qualifications for the job. Most qualifications can be taught. And this is something that I usually kind of go head to head with a lot of hiring managers about, is because they want to see some bullet points on a resume. And I tell them to throw that in the garbage, because a lot of those things can be taught. What you can't teach is, you can't teach somebody integrity. You can't teach somebody passion for the industry. You can't teach core competencies. And you need to know what core competencies you really value within your organization and for these specific roles. And so you start there, you get the right people in place. But that still doesn't mean, okay, now we've established that that's important, but that doesn't mean that you have an extra $120,000 a year to pay me to come on full time, or the ability to offer me those benefits or other things that it would take to attract me away from maybe a more established company that I'm already at. So enter outsourcing, where you can get a lot of that talent. And if you find a company where you agree with their core values, and you know that they will go after the, types of initiatives that you feel are important, you're saving money, you're getting somebody that's more aligned with your goals. Because truth be told, if you don't match up with an outsourced, they're a vendor, right? It's not the same as developing this employee-employer relationship, and now you have to go through that heartache. I've never met anybody that likes firing people. I've had people pretend like they like firing people just to save themselves from the emotional stress that it causes. Nobody likes to fire someone. So when you hire someone on and they're the wrong fit for your organization, it's a lot of heartache and it's a lot of stress that you go through. So it's nice to have a third party where, you can actually evaluate and assess a vendor relationship versus an employer.
Talk a little bit as we wind up this part of the conversation about how you actually package and deliver those services. You have a subscription model, you do project-based work. When somebody hires you to take over the HR functions, what are they getting? How's it delivered?
Okay, sure. So the way that we package our services is really flexible because we are dealing with a lot of different people at different points in their business. So sometimes that means that you have a one-time, let's say you're rolling out a benefits program, you need to do that one time. And for whatever reason, you don't need any services above and beyond that. You can actually engage us to do a one-time benefits implementation. It's a project pricing, and you can pay as you know, pay us as a vendor, and then you know what your costs are, and you're done. Right? It's a one-time expense. If you know that you're going to have ongoing issues, so some companies have employee relations issues that they need to wrap up. Some companies have things like recruiting, ongoing recruiting needs, and they know that they're going to be growing, and adding folks continually over the next 6 months or a year, they can put us on a subscription service. It saves significantly over what they would pay perhaps, you know, a full-time individual. And what typically ends up happening in those cases is we end up coming up with more projects and more things that that end up popping up because people tend to not understand what all HR encompasses when they engage in the initial subscription or the initial project. So we're always flexible. We can always add on throughout as we get to know each other and build that relationship. And it really can be anything as broad as we've talked a little bit about recruiting and employee relations, but it can cover things like employee trainings that need to be developed. We can be talking about more strategic high-level issues, so how to develop your company culture. Maybe you want to develop a more socially conscious business. So it really covers a lot of different areas. It can be tech stack implementation. So how do we increase our efficiency within our operation by implementing technical solutions? So we have a team that can cover that as well. So we really have this broad spectrum of things that we cover.
Marvelous. We may discuss some more of these as the conversation unfolds. Christina Moore, COO of Rebel HR. Thanks for sharing those insights and perspectives to kick off our conversation.
Thank you.
Let's turn to Alex Cushman. You're the president of Procure Solutions.
I am indeed.
And you mentioned that this involves chlorine dioxide.
Yes, it does.
Which has me having, you know, not pleasant flashbacks of high school chemistry. What is chlorine dioxide? What does Procure Solutions do?
Perfect. Yeah. And I'll try not to get too technical with you. And if I see your eyes start to roll back, I'll understand that I got a little too technical for you. But Procure, as you mentioned, is a company that makes a product that allows for water activation of chlorine dioxide, which, to answer your second question, chlorine dioxide is a very underutilized disinfectant and deodorizing powerhouse. But the problem with the chemistry in and of itself is that it requires you to make it on site. So it's a chemistry that's been used. Think Phoenix water municipalities, think large scale water deodorization, mitigating of odors. It's been used since the 1940s, but has required very large pieces of capital equipment. So basically what has to happen is you have to have an acid mixed with a chlorite in order to generate this chemistry. So therefore you've had to have very large applications or very large needs in order to manufacture this product on site.
And this is because chlorine dioxide itself in liquid or gas form is explosive.
Yes.
So you can't transport it.
Yes. So
in its actual form, you need to create the reaction that generates it once it's at the place it needs to be.
Yes. So this chemistry has been known. So think anthrax buildings. If everyone's familiar with the anthrax that happened in—
It's my favorite band in the mid to late 80s, I mean, but I know that's not the anthrax you're talking about.
That's why I bring it up. I knew that because you're wearing the shirt right now. But has been happening since the early 2000s is, so think the anthrax decontamination. This chemistry scaled up or scaled down. So scaled up, meaning at very high concentrations, was used to decontaminate the buildings that had anthrax. At very, very low levels is actually sprayed on fruits and vegetables to prolong shelf life. So think like your strawberries that you buy at your local market. In a lot of situations, will be sprayed with chlorine dioxide to ship across the country. So The chemistry or the rules that are that govern my life, which is the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, which is a requires you to be heavily compliant in everything you say and do, knows this chemistry at much higher concentrations. So it has been required that this has to be made on site because, as you specified, it's explosive in higher concentrations. So therefore, you have to have some level of mechanism to, up until this point, has been a machine in order to generate this chemistry. So Procure unveiled a patented pouch that basically allows the user in both liquid and gas forms to create chlorine dioxide on site safely, effectively, and predictably, which has been a huge benefit to a lot of our customers in the cannabis market.
Now, I want to understand a little bit more about those applications, but it reminds me, when you talk about a pouch, of those ice packs you used to have where you crush the part of it, the things inside mix. I'm not a chemist. I'm a doctor, not a physician.
See, I thought everyone with a PhD was a chemist.
Yeah, not all of us.
It gets awkward.
Just 89%. And it mixes two compounds inside, and the mixture creates the reaction that creates the cold.
Yes.
So are you, when you say a packet, is it something like that size or is it much larger? Describe the actual
delivery. It scales up or scales down, but in most cases, think 3.5 by 5 inches. It's very similar to the ice pack that you're discussing, but what it is, it's a little Tyvek pouch that separates the two raw ingredients from one another. And when exposed to water, it allows them to transport themselves and mix across what is called a hyperbolic membrane and allows for chlorine dioxide to be generated.
So taking the oxygen molecules
crossing over and creating.
I actually remember chemistry class, not very well, but
fair enough.
Yeah. Now, why is this important in the cannabis industry? Who needs it and what does it do?
So we have, who needs it? That's a really good question. The entire market, as we've seen, has been dealing with a lot of upstream and downstream problems in terms of mold remediation, products that are being found downstream within, as we've even seen within the vaping cartridges. But what is happening is that a lot of these cultivators don't have a solution to essentially create an answer for what would be state regulated testing that each of them have. As regulations vary state by state of what can be in a product and what can't be in a product. And what we have found is just like with any crop, in growing marijuana and growing hemp, you are creating perfect conditions for mold and mildew to grow. I mean, just think, relatively heat, high heat,
moisture,
relatively high humidity, and you have organic material. So if you don't have great IPM or integrated pest management solutions, or you don't have very great protocols or SOPs, it's not a matter of if you're going to get a breakout, it's a matter of when. And if you think about this marketplace, just as you had kind of specified historically, you have a lot of younger growers that have now been trusted with very large amounts of capital from private equity firms or from, you know, family offices, and suddenly growing in a basement is not the same as growing in, you know, 100,000 square feet. So the practices that may or may not have been acceptable in those smaller basements when this was an illicit market are suddenly not legal or causing people harm downstream in the larger market. So essentially creating an environment that is controlled and consistent is very important to these growers.
So your clients are primarily the grow side of the business.
You're
dealing directly with the cultivators who have plants growing in large scale facilities.
Yes.
That need to be processed and handled there. They got to sometimes be moved from one room to another room, et cetera, et cetera. And all throughout the entire facility, you've got, as we said earlier, heat and moisture.
Yes.
And
humans, which essentially creates a cross-contamination point. So a lot of this has been, just within this marketplace, has been taking, as Christina mentioned very eloquently, it's taking what are some of the best practices of other marketplaces and utilizing what are the talents of, again, keep in mind in this marketplace, very few people have been in this market for very long. So you're taking some of the best talents from other industries, and we have to get this to a very safe, predictable product as quickly as possible. I mean, for the entire industry, for HR to work, for any of these professional services to exist, we have to have a product that consumers can consume safely and understand what's in it, be very transparent with it, and have growers that are held accountable and that understand exactly what they're putting in, not only from a state-by-state perspective, but as soon as obviously this gets declassified as a Class 1 federal substance, what is and what is not allowed.
Yeah. I mean, it really, if you think of it from the perspective of agriculture and things that people consume in whatever way they do, there's so many issues here when it comes to regulation. You mentioned the EPA, but also simply the safety of the product. Nobody wants to be ingesting mold. That's not good for you. And, you know, there's a lot of scrutiny, I suppose, around this particular industry, given some of the stereotypes and conversations about it. But in reality, no large-scale growing operation that is servicing the legal distribution of this plant wants to deal with either the massive losses that come with a mold outbreak. I mean, that could cost millions and millions of dollars worth of product if it gets throughout an entire thing, or with the potential lawsuits, or with the, you know, dealing with the regulators. I mean, it's just, it's a very fraught field. Now, your background is not in this.
It is not.
You started a sports drink company out of college, right?
We
did. So how did you get from, let's go back, wind the clock back a little bit to younger Alex studying at Pomona College, and then you launched this thing. Like, walk us forward.
Let me take you back a little bit. So I don't know if no one's read it, this might be awkward, but there's a book called Range, written by David Epstein, that basically specifies that most executives in today's environment do not have highly specialized skills. They actually are much more benefited by having a broad array of various backgrounds, and then taking what they learn in those backgrounds and then applying them to what is that said pivotal moment in their life, and in which they find something that aligns not only with them morally, but, you know, from an execution standpoint. As you specified, in fact, I'm going to get even weirder on you. So I graduated from Pomona College and actually wrote my senior thesis on the Amish. So again, if you could not
get— What was your degree?
I was history major.
Yeah.
So I'm going to rewind this and make it even weirder. So a history major—
That's not that weird. I was having a phone conversation yesterday with somebody about the Mennonites, which is not the same, but the same ballpark.
Slightly more technology, but again, I can't imagine that they are growing marijuana in their basements at this point.
So it's unlikely.
It's unlikely at best. So we will agree to that point. But yeah, though, and then after that, I actually walked into my advisor's office many, many years ago and asked them what I could do with a history degree. And they told me I could either be a lawyer or I could work as a librarian. And I had just gotten done writing my thesis and thought neither of those options appealed to me whatsoever. So entered the world of finance, worked in investment banking for the better part of 7 years. And then, as you alluded to, actually opened up a consumer product business that a partner and I started from the ground up in the energy drink space, which you do tend to find that a lot of the executives of some of your larger multi-state operators are actually coming out of the energy drink market. Again, another market that was heavily regulated. A lot of litigation in that marketplace in terms of how you market, who you can sell to, and the end consumer base. Had launches in Whole Foods, Costco, Sprouts. I mean, you name major chain, the business was in there. And then had my first child, moved back to Phoenix. It fundamentally changes your life. So I moved back to Phoenix, Arizona, started consulting for a chemical company. Realized the large market opportunity with, aligns with my passion of, this is something that I fundamentally believe the next generation needs to have access to what I believe is an amazing medicine. If researched and used appropriately, has some very amazing attributes that I think the next generation is going to more fully realize than did our generation. But what I was starting to realize in doing some of my initial market analysis and going into some of these cultivators is that there are some practices that I was unaware of as a consumer, and really wanted to make sure that if I was going to stand for something, it was going to be for clean cannabis and for transparency of said product. And in this product in this marketplace has really allowed me the ability to at least force not only our company, but I think as we continue to grow, to force this kind of the underbelly of the market to at least people to know about it, at least for it to be an awareness and a decision a consumer can make, fully knowing what is in their product, knowing that this has gone from an illicit market to a half-baked legal market. And as that process continues, we want to make sure that the companies that are doing this have the consumer in mind versus what is big money and some of the practices that I think you see with some of the big businesses as, you know, money gets thrown around. What then becomes the concentration of these companies? And for us, it is make sure that people are doing this as cleanly as possible. And we knew that chlorine dioxide in these forms could be very beneficial to these grow environments and could help eliminate some chemistries that should not be used in this marketplace.
What about that background, the sort of startup CPG brand, distribution deals, all the things that were necessary to pull off the energy drink company, now informs what is essentially a B2B business where you're navigating a relatively different landscape. What carries over and what's different?
Whew, that's a really good question. So I connect with people. So for me, there's a fundamental skill set that you need in order to run a business and in order to connect with your employees and to galvanize a force, so to speak. So for me, it was finding something. And again, you can replace the business. I mean, so to speak, within how you look at how you run a company, you can replace the specific business. But what a business becomes, it becomes a series of people. As Christina talked about it from the HR perspective, it becomes a series of finding fabulous people, motivating fabulous people, and putting them on a trajectory in which they outshine what even you could have believed. And I think for me, what I learned in finance is, look, I can put financial models together left and right. It transcends the financial model. It becomes, I can't tell that Excel spreadsheet how to do this. So it comes down to, do you have people skills? Do you genuinely care about your people? And can you put them in a position where they can see the end goal? You can see what is the larger picture of what we're all looking to accomplish. And you put them all in positions where they put me in a great position. They put me in a position in which, you know, we have a very fast growing organization. I think those are the skill sets that I learned in that process, which was the emotional intelligence and the how to learn. And I think that is very similar to, you know, how I feel about just generally education is teaching someone how, not teaching someone the specific problems, but allowing them the tools to take what are problems that exist that may not exist today, that it will exist 10 years from now, and being able to take those and break them into component parts and then finding a great team that can go help you execute.
I couldn't agree more. I feel that curiosity and learning how to learn are two superpowers that are not taught.
100%.
But inform a productive and flourishing life regardless of whatever 100%. Field of endeavor. So if people drive the whole thing and that's what you're passionate about, talk to us a little bit about the team at Procure. What kinds of specialties do you employ? How do you execute on your vision
Perfect.
Of providing, you know, clean, safe cannabis to the world?
Beautiful. So we have, we have a fabulous team, but for us, it's a series of people with diverse skill sets. As again, as I kind of spoke to, very few people have very direct experience in this marketplace. So you have to go out and find certain skill sets and certain personality types within the organization. We have backed ourselves with who I would call the foremost chemist in chlorine dioxide. His name is Dr. Bernie Lorenz. He is a brilliant mind, one who genuinely cares about consumers and customers. So for us, it's a very logical fit in a human being that I care about. We have Brian Spivey, who comes out of Red Bull. Again, another overlap in terms of a highly regulated market, fabulous human being, very emotionally intelligent, and someone who, again, I highly care about. And we have, which we haven't even spoken about, we have an entire other side of our business which handles restoration. So think ServPro, think ServiceMaster, those types of organizations. We have a couple of fabulous individuals, Ken Bazaar, Jason Lipsey, who have been with the organization even longer than I have, who again are technically experts in this field. People who, as we are bringing a chemistry out to market that we want consumers to be very knowledgeable about, it's very important that we have a staff that A, cares, and B, is very highly educated in being able to walk consumers through, as not everyone has a PhD after their name, and even fewer of those who do have PhDs after their name know anything about chemistry. So being able to then bring this down to what is a chemistry and a approachable chemistry for people, I think is very important.
Yeah. Now, your market is not only Arizona. You
Yes.
deliver your solutions to
every state that that is medically cleared for cannabis, yes.
And talk a little bit about the process of growing and expanding your reach. What kinds of activities are you engaged in to develop relationships, which I know drive this industry as
Yes.
any, but they're especially important here. How are you, what's your kind of expansion and vision for how you're going to, obviously there's currently limited number of states.
Yes.
But even within those states, there's untapped opportunity.
And it's a very secretive market as well. So you would think, I mean, again, in any B2B business, it would be able to go onto a search profile and go find the name of every cultivator and their email address and go approach them. So not as easy in this marketplace. For us, it's been a series of really building trust with people. We in the early stages decided, look, in this marketplace, there's going to be Budweiser's, there's going to be IPAs. This marketplace, very similar to other markets, is going to professionalize, and people are going to have to kind of pick where they are in the market. We hitched our wagons very aggressively to a lot of the top growers in the country, both from a size perspective as well as from a multi-state operator perspective. And we decided, look, we know at the end of the day that there's only going to be a certain number of people that end up winning this industry. So for us, it was a matter of, can we fundamentally prove science with science? Can we utilize our protocols and our chemistries and show them with proof that they lower the amount of breakouts that they have in a facility, and as they grow, we grow with them. So again, it becomes kind of as you're playing poker, a series of bets. You can only make so many bets, and for us, it was, we're going to bet on a lot of individuals that we have now seen facilities for. We know that they have PhDs and MBA. I mean, people who in this marketplace have been very seasoned and very professional, who, again, as we spoke to earlier, bring some of the best practices from other marketplaces. They were going to be the individuals that we grew with, and thus far has worked out extremely well.
What kind of a presence do you need to have in order to build those relationships? How do you actually do it? Is it trade shows? Is it site visits?
Great question. So it's a series, but fundamentally, it's site visits. It is getting specs of their facilities. It's going out and actually, because again, no facility is cookie cutter in this marketplace. A lot of these are buildings that have sick building syndrome to start with. So again, it without having any of that knowledge to begin with, you can't write a custom SOP in order to help them. So a lot of this is, we have a fabulous team of cultivation professionals that are going across the country, meeting with these individuals, testing the facilities, coming back with specific protocols. And then we maintain weekly relationships with each of these growers, and we'll help monitor their facilities on a weekly basis. Because for us, we fundamentally believe that there's also a lot of knowledge growth that happens in the exchange of information.
There must be other specialized companies that are working alongside you to deliver the same result. I mean, what kind of ventilation and environmental control and,
yes,
whatever sort of, and again, I'm an outsider to this, so I'm just thinking, like, you know, thermostats and there's, you know.
It's a whole program. So it's, again, what we like to call ourselves, so our Chief Science Officer, Dr. Bernie Lorenz, gives a lot of speeches at some of the larger cannabis conferences. And a lot of it is just generally educating people on what is an IPM program. What is steps 1 through 10?
Integrated pest management.
So we as chlorine dioxide and as Procure, maybe steps 8 and 9, but if you don't follow the basic tenets of what is sanitation and what is cleanliness from the get-go, as you spoke through HVAC units, wearing gloves, having beard nets, I mean, just very silly things that, again, or leaving doors open from cross-contamination, where you put your mother room, where you put your clone room. There are very basic tenets that then allow you the ability at that point to then use chlorine dioxide for steps 8 and 9. But there are a lot of products that are identifying what is this larger issue in the marketplace, which is contaminated product that people are having to come up with downstream solutions for that is not safe for the consumer.
Yeah, and circling back to what Christina was talking about, you know, it's people doing all of these things. You can develop protocols, but if you're not having the right training, the right support, the right, you know, quality control, there's actual execution of this process at the human level.
Yes.
So it really is an integrated.
Well, and think about even this further is that in this marketplace, I mean, again, I think as what we'll hear here in a second is that change is constant. But what we find in these environments is that a lot of the growers have become more and more and more professionals. You're starting to see people with advanced degrees that are coming into these environments where you might have trained someone 2 years ago who could barely keep their eyes open and having a conversation with you. It's the state of this industry. And now, 2 years later, you're getting people who are writing very detailed notes, who are going and looking at white papers, who are taking 3 steps further, and it's happening at a much faster rate, which this industry needs, and it needs further transparency as we get more professional as an industry.
Marvelous. Alex Cushman, president of Procure Solutions. Thank you so much for those insights.
Thank you.
It's a really rich conversation. And let's turn to Ed Cheney, CEO of Canafil CBD. Ed, tell us a little bit about Canafil. You're a Phoenix-based manufacturer of full-spectrum CBD-infused products. For folks who aren't familiar with that, can you break it down for us and tell us what kind of work you do?
Well, sure I can. So, Adrian, I think first it is important, as I started to build this company, that it was going to run down a clinical approach. when I first decided to enter into this industry, it was because my mother had cancer. I thought to get CBD to help with her treatment of that. And when I looked into the industry, I found two things. One is the product that was currently out there just was not enough. And the second thing I observed is there's no business skills out there. There was no standards. There was no acumen. So I jumped into the space. And when I created the Cannafil mission, it was to create trust in the market. So thereby, I took the position of leading the standards in the CBD space. And I've held on to that for a good 2 years now.
Yeah. You mentioned it wasn't enough. You're talking about potency in order to produce the effect, or what does that mean, it wasn't enough?
Let's just start with potency. Potency certainly was the biggest. When I jumped into the space, or when I was looking for this product to help my mother out, the maximum strength of a 1 ounce bottle was in that range of 175 milligrams. Today gets up to 4,000 and 5,000 milligrams for that same size bottle. So yes, the potency, it lacked the potency back in that day. But the other thing is there was nothing there to understand and be confident about what was actually in the bottle, where the product came from, how it was put in there. Nothing out there at all about that.
Let's take a step back for folks who may not be familiar with CBD. They've maybe heard the acronym by now because it's getting a lot of attention at some level in a consumer market. A lot of companies sprouting up, a lot of network marketing thing. I mean, it's everywhere. And I know there's going to be a lot of things we need to unpack here to clarify some of this. But what is CBD and why do people use it?
Certainly, CBD is a cannabinoid found in most plants. We also have cannabinoids inside of our body, and we have a cannabinoid system. Now, the best way I've been able to explain this over the years is considered cannabinoid like CBD, THC, CBN. Those are all cannabinoids as a key for the CB receptors that are in the human body. That key designed to activate those receptors. These receptors throughout your body are designed to do specific things, and that key, it's necessary to unlock them or trigger them to activate.
You know, as general awareness, and this is a field that I think even medical science is still trying to grapple with, we understand the interdependencies between systems in the body, but I think now people are more aware of how neurotransmitters work and that there are, as you say, keys that fit certain locks and that there are receptors for, you know, hormones and neurotransmitters and, you know, whether it's, you know, serotonin or things of that nature, there's an understanding of that. How long have people been aware that there were endocannabinoid receptors in the human body that are a match for the keys, so to speak, in these plants?
You know, Adrian, I don't know that I have the answer to that question. I certainly know that the study of hemp and its potential, specifically the cannabinoids, have been out for quite a while.
Now, you mentioned a string of acronyms there, and I think one of the important distinctions to make is the difference between CBD products and THC products. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, let's go ahead and talk about that. So in the hemp plant, there are literally hundreds of cannabinoids in there. The most volume is in CBD, and this is the hemp plant, not to be confused with the marijuana plant. Both these plants are in the cannabis family.
Just like potatoes and tomatoes are in a similar family, but they're not the same plant.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. So, and so when we look to what are the differences between these two, CBD and THC? Well, CBD does not have psychoactive properties or characteristics to it. So you can take much more of it. All right. Now, if you have an issue or a need for these cannabinoids to be in your system to unlock these CB receptors to help you to deal with a specific issue you might have, well, you can certainly take a lot more CBD than you can THC. You take that volume of THC and you're on the couch and listen to Led Zeppelin for a while.
Right. So this is not a psychoactive substance. It does not alter your perception. It does not get you high. It is something that is, however, bioactive in the sense of it is supportive of certain things in the body. So why do people use CBD products? I mean, the range of things that are now available and that Cannafil provides include tinctures, topical lotions and salves, cartridges, pet food additives. What's this all for? What how does CBD help people?
Well, sure, Adrian. And let me put this into two groups too. So there are disease issues that we take care of, and then there are functional issues that we need to take care of. Now, the functional issues are sleep. They would be pain and anxiety. Those are the three very common uses for CBD in that functional group. And we come to disease claims or disease treatments. Because this product was just recently declassified, it's tough to really get to cite too many studies on it because they've all just begun.
Well, and as Alex mentioned earlier, there are regulations and limits on claims that could be made. And I think that's appropriate. Rather than asking you to make those claims on behalf of the products, I'm curious to know why people use it, what their understanding is. Your consumers are buying it for a variety of reasons. Can you kind of give us the spectrum of those?
Yes, absolutely. And I appreciate you putting it that way. So what we find is most of our customers that are coming in and purchasing Cannafil products are doing it because they want to alleviate their pain and they do not want to do it with a prescription opioid.
Right.
Now,
because this is non-addictive any more than olive oil is inert in the sense of you don't need more of it just because you had some yesterday.
That is correct. Yes, you're very correct. And it is as effective.
Yeah.
And that's what keeps everybody coming back to it and creating confidence in it. The next one would be sleep. Now, and I have personal experience. I jumped into this space, and as an entrepreneur for 30 years, sleep is something that is extremely valuable to my production and contributing to my family. It's just extremely valuable.
The role of sleep, my wife and I were just talking about this via text because she's in California right now. Last night, the role of sleep in mental health and wellness has been overlooked for too long. We got to start being more serious, especially those who are driven and want to make things happen and need to squeeze more out of the day, parents of small children.
Yes.
Sleep is super important. So that's what got you connected to it, that in your mother's
that
story?
Yeah, outside of my mother's story, that's what got me connected to it. And so when I look at the alternatives, and I have tried plenty of alternatives, I've tried fitness, holistic, pharmacy products, and they all end up the same way. You get half a night's sleep. It's either the first half or the second half. You wake up feeling this way, you wake up feeling that way. Oh my goodness, it was terrible. And when I first experienced CBD, the fact that it was holistic, naturally plant-based, and it gave me such a good night's sleep, that was a big driver for me to ensure this product was of high quality.
And one thing I think we can say definitively, at least I'll say it, is there are no indications in any way, shape, or form that there is harm associated with these compounds, which cannot be said of any prescription sleep aid. Every single one of those has side effects, has harmful things. They may be a small percentage, et cetera. I'm not worried about the pharmaceutical industry coming after me for saying this. It's in their own literature. They try to downplay it, sure. But there is no indication of harm. Yes?
That's correct. And as a matter of fact, FDA even released a statement. I'd like to cite it, but it would be out of respect for them to actually cite it by word. Yeah. But they did release a statement about 4 months ago, citing something very similar to that.
Yeah. Now, let's talk a little bit about how this is all made. So hemp, not marijuana, is the plant so industrial hemp or things that are covered by the recent farm bill. So this is a plant that can be grown and used for a lot of different purposes, fabric, rope, all kinds of things. How is CBD extracted from hemp and how do you actually get it into the consumer products that you deliver to people?
Well, certainly it's a good question. So, and I can't get too technical on it. The extraction methods are evolving.
Yep.
Quite frequently, and there's a lot of innovation in that space. But it is very important to us where that product is extracted from within the plant.
Yes.
These days, we see a lot of inexpensive CBD products on the market, and we can pretty much determine by the price of the product where that CBD was extracted from. As an example,
Do you mean which part of the plant, or do you mean where in the world?
No, which part of the plant. Okay. So when I look at the hemp plant, long, scraggly looking plant, and majority of it is stalk, and then you have some leaves and a small amount of flowers. So as I understood the last time I looked at a quote, a pound of hemp stalk is $24. A pound of hemp leaves is $750. All right. Now the extract.
It takes a lot of leaves to get a pound as well.
It does. And I think the bioavailability of the CBD extracted from the leaves is much more than the stalk.
Yeah. Now, there's, in my limited knowledge of this, there's another issue with CBD, which is the plants themselves are very good at extracting heavy minerals and things from the soil. Sometimes hemp plants are planted to help clean the fields in between crop cycles. And then those plants might have higher toxicity than other plants. Is this true? This is kind of something I read loosely out there. I don't know. Is that an issue?
So it probably is an issue. And again, Adrian, I don't have any specifics on it, but here's what we do. We investigate the farmer quite thoroughly, and then the farmer has to do a 5-point third-party test before we'll accept their products. And it's within that testing that tests for pesticides, metals, solvents, mold. All those things are tested for us. So once we know that we have that vendor and that vendor's been checked out, and then their product is delivered to us, then it goes through a testing system again for the same things, and we do it per batch. So yes, I believe those issues are present out there, and this is how we deal with them at Canafil.
Yeah, and I think this is important to make this distinction, because that's a level of care and attention that people might not find if they were to look under the hood, so to speak, of many of these products that are widely now available. So you're manufacturing here in the Valley?
Yeah, here in the Valley, we have a lab in Phoenix. And I just want to go a little further on that subject, if you don't mind.
Please.
As Alex even spoke to earlier, being that this is an unregulated space, company owners like myself are in a position to self-police. And it is that responsibility and that need for me to follow our company's mission, which is to be a trusted supplier in the market, that is driving those kind of activities.
Yeah, I'm so glad you said that, Ed, because this is, again, something I think consumers need to be more conscious of. Are they buying their products from a company that they know and trust, that where they can verify the testing or whatever, answer whatever curiosity they might have about where this stuff come from? Or are they buying lower cost products from companies that are simply trying to capitalize on the explosion of interest in CBD products? And, it really matters, because you're ingesting this stuff.
And it's a fair question, because low quality has a low barrier of entry into this market space. And so somebody shoving a lot of money out the door and not focusing in on the product quality, well, the consumer's not seeing that. Yeah. And it really is. And then they get this product at home and they try it and they don't get the expectations that they were sold. And then they get turned off on CBD. And again, to the conversation with Alex and Christina, is what a shame. It is a magical miracle that this product has come along.
Right.
And I think the owners of the companies today need to nurture this, and we need to protect it until regulation steps in.
And continuing beyond, I mean, what you, self-regulation, I think, is the sign of a mature and healthy industry. And certainly in many industries where there have been problematic issues related to the sourcing of their materials, things like the Kimberley process for diamonds or conflict related thing, when conscious, committed, like-minded people come together and say, wait a minute, let's start creating our own regulations. I mean, I remember this is way out in left field, more than Alex's mention of the Amish, but a few years ago, in a different life, I was at a conference at NYU Law School about private military companies, essentially mercenary companies, working in the Middle East and Africa, an area where I'd spent a lot of years. And this was the big question, like, how do we regulate ourselves, given there's a lot of bad behavior in this space, former military members now making, $250,000 a year on these personal security details, and bad stuff happens. How are we going to regulate ourselves to really elevate the professionalism and the integrity, an important word Christina brought into the conversation, without needing to wait for the regulation to happen. Let's do it first and let's do it right. And then regulation can come in as well, but let's inform the regulators by our already existing practices, agreements, standards.
That's how it normally happens, yes.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned your 30-year experience in informing what you're doing now with Canafil. Talk to us a little bit about that background. You didn't start out as a young man thinking you were going to end up making these kind of products. Walk us through that trajectory.
So it started when I was in ASU. I opened my first business there. Funny as it was an indoor tanning center, so I was quite the hit on campus. A young man with a tanning salon that right next to the campus. And
that was a smart move socially.
It was perfect, right? And I grew that to six locations while going to school. And so I saw that I had an appetite for it. And my appetite turned out to be more of an artistic approach. Like, I understood how to bring people together. I understood how to make, you know, them collaborate and execute. And so that then became my interest. And from that, I've probably moved into a dozen businesses. I easily could say I failed half of them and succeeded with the other half. So in my 30 years, what I bring to the table today is a lot of lessons learned, a lot of patience, and that's pretty heavy shoulders.
Well, as I always say, especially the young people, look, I don't know what you're hearing from other grownups, but I will tell you that I've never learned anything except the hard way. So I'll give you my best advice, but I'm counting on you not following it, because I know you won't follow half of it anyway, because you're gonna fall down, you're gonna scrape your knees, you're gonna learn things yourself, and those are the best kind of lessons anyway, because then they belong to you. It's not something that I said. So I think we need to do a better job of embracing our failures and really celebrating. If you come out the other side, you're still winning.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. And, you know, we should do a better job of teaching this to our youth as well.
Absolutely.
I mean, I adopted that statement a long time ago. Mother Nature, she's cruel. But wow, is she a great teacher.
Yeah, she really is the best, actually, and the one that we tend to ignore, I think, at our peril. As we wrap up this conversation, I could keep talking to all of you about this. It's so fascinating and interesting to me. But I'd love to get a sense from each of you, starting with Ed, and we'll work our way back around. As you look forward to the future, what do you see happening in this industry in the next, let's say, 5 years or so? What are the opportunities? What lights you up and excites you? What's inspiring about what's coming?
Yeah, so I think, to be honest, deregulation would certainly make things a lot easier.
Yeah.
Innovation. I think Alex is contributing to that. I think the biggest space that's being innovated right now are the suppliers from the ground up. And that innovation, it's absolutely needed. And from there, I believe the end product is going to innovate. I love the idea of a handful of really strong players that earn the right to be at the top of the space. That's the people I want to call my peers. I'm excited to see that come. And the banking. Once deregulation happens, you know, the banks are all going to be on board. My seniors and my veterans and all these people that I really want to help are now going to be free to help. So those are the things that excite me right now.
You know, again, we won't be able to explore these in this conversation, but I hope to follow up with this threads on future episodes, because you named some of the most important issues. If you think about innovation in other industries, those new products, new solutions, new delivery mechanisms were able to go straight to the marketplace and be sold without requiring additional innovation or legal issues, simply that, you know, the fact that you could start a business selling raspberry jam, and you can open a Shopify store, and you can start collecting payments for your product immediately, and you can't do that in a regulated industry like this. You need to have innovation on the payment side, on the legal and regulatory side, on the customer awareness side. I mean, there's just so much, and that's partly what's exciting to you?
It is. I think we had a conversation earlier. Expect that the unexpected will happen, and if you can embrace that, this is a pretty exciting run.
Ed Chaney, CEO of Canafil. Where do people learn more about you, and where do they buy Canafil?
So www.canafil.com, that's CANNAFYL.com, and you'll see all our reseller locations. We tend to lean towards, you know, doctor offices, pain management, chiropractors, even pharmacies. Our locations will be on site. I will be on that website, but you can also see us or see all the blogs and the papers and the documents and the testing to help you become a better informed buyer.
Marvelous. Thank you so much, Ed, for joining us today. Alex Cushman, what inspires you? What do you see coming down the pipe in the next 5 years? What should we be looking out for? What are the opportunities?
Good question. I think to speak, Ed, I think put it beautifully in terms of innovation. And the way I see it on our side is there's going to be a lot more R&D. I think just for all of our knowledge, and I know everyone here in this room is aware of, but there has not been the ability to test any of these products outside of Israel, outside of Mississippi State University, outside of Canada to some respects. So I think the knowledge is going to drive the innovation. And I think what excites me is being able to take a fundamental position of this has got to get done the right way. For me, this is one of the last major frontiers for, for like the millennials, this is a galvanizing topic. This is a voter topic. This is something that I think moves a lot of people. So for me, there's a way to do this right. There's a way to ensure transparency. There's a way to educate the consumer where, to Ed's point, as a self-regulated market, you are giving a product to someone who potentially has a compromised immune system and you're hiding the ball from them. And I think what I'm excited about is when you shine light on something, you create shadows. And I think by shining a light on this industry and exposing what needs to be exposed and for people to have the knowledge, the consumer to have the knowledge, it's going to drive the research and development. It's going to drive the innovation very quickly. And to Ed's point, the cream will rise because I fundamentally believe if we force transparency and we force research and development, look, money moves, but at the same time that if people are aware of what is fundamentally happening in this marketplace, consumers can vote in order to make sure that they get the innovation that they want. And it's not being driven purely by dollars. Because at the end of the day, for me as a parent, this is an industry that I want to make sure is done right, is done very transparently, and one that I can look my kids in the eye when they're adults and say, I took a small part in forcing. Look, Procure might not have won this, but the company that beat Procure, we forced them in a direction to do this in a way that was very transparent, very clean, and now you know what is in your product. For me, that's what excites me, is being able to take those fundamental steps and making sure people do this the right way.
I love that, and I love the passion behind it. Alex Cushman, president of Procure Solutions, thank you very much for
joining
us today.
Thank you for having me.
Christina Morse with Rebel HR. What do you see coming? What's important? What excites you and lights you up about the future?
Well, I think what lights... Oh, am I there? Okay. What lights me up really about the future is... One, on the consumer side, making this more readily available and more socially acceptable for the consumer, because I really believe in the healing products. And I really think that we need to make this more widely acceptable. For me personally, I love dealing with the brilliant and risk-tolerant entrepreneurs that I've been working with so far in the industry. I just really get a charge out of helping these people grow their businesses, and I want to see them all be successful, and I just love partnering with all the connections that I have in the industry so far. So,
marvelous. Christina Morse from Rebel HR, thank you very much for sharing your insights and your perspective with us today. For all of us here at Business Radio X, this is Dr. Adrian McIntyre, and we'll see you next time on Valley Business Radio.